Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the debate in Washington is currently about whether to increase revenues or cut spending, or a compromise that will do both, here in Oklahoma, the legislature is looking at reducing tax revenues by cutting the top rate of the personal income tax, despite a number of pressing needs in education, DHS, corrections, and infrastructure. There are two tax cut plans on the table: Governor Fallon's proposal, which is reflected in the House, and the state Senate has their own plan. To explain them, I'm joined by fiscal analyst David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, an Oklahoma think tank on state policies, which I should mention has opposed both of the tax cut plans. He joins us to describe the governor's plan, the Senate plan, as well as some of those pressing needs we talked about earlier. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it is springtime in Oklahoma. That means the legislature is talking about tax cuts, and we have two proposals out there. And after a year in which the final tax cut proposal actually would raise taxes on most of the middle class, that was last session, we've come back with two plans, the governor's plan, and then the state Senate has come up with an alternative plan. Can you give us a sort of a primer to these two tax cut plans?
Sure. Well, let me step back a little bit and say, if you'll recall, last year there were some pretty extreme measures being proposed. The governor would have taken the top income tax rate down to 3% right away. Currently, it's 5.25% is the top rate. She would have taken it down to 3% right away and then phased it out over a period of time.
The glide path to zero, yes.
Glide path to zero.
Yes.
There were various plans put forward last year, and until the very end of session, the governor and the Republican leadership in the House and Senate could not come up with any agreement. Finally, in the waning days of session, there was an agreement between the governor, the House Speaker, and the Senate President for a more modest tax cut that would have taken the top rate down to about 4.8%, offset some of the lost revenue by doing away with various tax breaks, including limiting the personal exemption for families earning over $70,000 a year.
And those tax breaks meant that most middle-income wage earners were going to see actually a tax increase.
Some would have. Depending on your income and your family composition, some would have. And that aspect of it was probably primarily responsible for the plan being defeated. Basically, the House Speaker realized he didn't have the votes to get the bill passed in the House because a number of his Republican members saw it as a tax increase. So last year, in the final days of session, there were various attempts to get it going. All of those failed, and the governor glumly acknowledged the day before adjournment that there would be no tax cut. This year, we are starting with a pair of more modest proposals. And as you said, the governor has one plan. The Senate Republicans have another one. The governor's is a straight cut in the top income tax rate. Take the top rate, which is now 5.25, and cut that to 5.0%. There are House bills backed by the Speaker that would basically implement the governor's plan. The Senate's plan is a little bit more complicated. It would actually take the top rate lower from 5.25 to 4.75%. It would offset some of that revenue, about half of the lost revenue, by doing away with a variety of tax credits and deductions. And then also, it would not go into effect until the year after next. It basically gives a year's grace, and it would not take effect until the 2015 tax year rather than the 2014 tax year. So the Senate plan looks more like the agreement that was reached at the end of last session, which took the top rate a little lower but tried to offset part of the revenue by doing away with a variety of tax breaks and credits.
And the tax breaks and credits, I think one of the ones I've heard about is the oil and gas credit, which is, you know, we have this incredible drilling boom here right in the state, but we're not getting the revenue, say, a state like Texas is from their drilling boom, or North Dakota, because we've exempted this type of drilling from the gross production tax.
It's an interesting topic. This was put into place 20 years ago when horizontal and deep well drilling were still experimental and costly drilling techniques.
And now oil prices standard, were in the tank, too.
Right. Now they're standard industry fare, and pretty much every new rig being drilled in Oklahoma is being drilled horizontally, but we don't tax it. We basically exempt the entire tax. We still tax 1% rather than 7% for traditional drilling. We essentially exempt it for the first 48 months of production. And with horizontal drilling, most of your production comes early on. There's a very steep decline curve. So we are losing hundreds of millions of dollars from this exemption of horizontal drilling. Now, in the Senate's plan that does do away with certain tax credits, those tax breaks for the oil and gas industry are not on the table in that plan. But there is growing talk that the legislative leaders and even some in the oil industry do recognize that this preferential treatment for horizontal drilling is, as we've called it, unaffordable and unnecessary. And there have been some discussions to curtail those tax breaks, but it's not currently part of either the governor's plan or the Senate's plan. The tax breaks the Senate would do away with are income tax credits for a variety of business activities, rehabilitating historic buildings, zero emission facilities, a wind tax credit, coal tax credits, and then also some that are taken more broadly. There would again be looking at curtailing the personal exemption, curtailing the child tax credit and the dependent care tax credit or child care tax credit. Currently, you can take that if you have income up to $100,000 under this plan. You would only be eligible for a state child tax credit or child care tax credit if your income was under $50,000.
Will that still lead to tax increases for certain people in the $50,000 to $75,000 range or somewhere
it
in there?
It would still lead. The Tax Commission has done an analysis of it, which shows that under the Senate plan, because it does actually still have, it's a net tax cut. They've talked about revenue neutrality, but in fact, it is still a net tax cut of about $125 million. So many people will get a tax cut. Some, it won't be affected at all. For the most part, if you have low income and you're not in the top income tax bracket, you're likely going to be unaffected. But there are certain categories of people who currently, who might lose the state personal exemption, who might lose the child tax credit or the child care tax credit, who would see an increase. And I think the numbers were about 10 to 15% of Oklahomans who would see a tax increase. The other side of it, which we have to look at, is both of these main tax cut proposals would mean lost revenue, which means less funding available to shore up funding for state services.
Would both of these plans be top-heavy as far as where the tax cut lays?
If absolutely.
A person making several $100,000 a year, maybe even $500,000 a year, is going to see a huge tax cut compared to the rest of the population?
This is where the numbers are pretty shocking. If you look at the governor's plan, which would simply cut taxes for the top income tax rate, take it down from 5.25 to 5%, that would have a fiscal impact, according to the Tax Commission, of about $110 million a year. Two out of every five households would see no benefit at all because they're not in the top income tax bracket. So 42% of households would get no tax cut at all. Among those who would get a tax cut, the median household would get a $39 tax cut. But if you're in the top 10%, 5%, 1%, because more of your income is taxed at that top rate, that's where you see the benefit. So 70% of the total benefit, around $70 million of the tax cut, would go to those in the top 20% of households, those making over roughly $80,000, $90,000 a year. So it is very much a skewed tax cut for upper-income families who generally are doing well. And we really have to wonder why, when our top rate is only 5.25%, how much benefit are we getting from cutting this top rate compared to the funds that aren't going to be available to try to restore cuts to schools, to public safety, to human services?
You mentioned these three areas where we've seen lots of cuts over the last 4 years when our economy was contracting. And what you've seen is really those levels really haven't come back too much, especially education.
Education has been hit really hard. If you look at funding for the state aid formula, which is what schools use to pay for teachers and support staff and administration and transportation and so on, we have seen, compared to 4 years ago, that state aid has been cut by over $200 million, close to a 12% cut. during the same period, public schools are serving around 30,000 more kids. So per pupil funding has been cut quite steeply. In fact, the national study done by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities showed that Oklahoma has seen the third worst cut, over 20% if you adjust for inflation, in per pupil funding, third worst cuts of any state in the nation. So we have been hit really hard. I think all your listeners out there who have kids, grandkids, or neighbors' kids in the public schools have seen the impact in terms of fewer teachers, larger class sizes, fewer class offerings. It's really had a real impact. We also have had, we're seeing now the impact of federal funding being cut with budget cuts took effect last year and now with the sequester. We're also seeing potentially large cuts in local property tax revenues. So schools are really going through what could be called the triple whammy from state, local, and federal funding. And the situation is really serious.
You also have two other areas where, if anything, it looks like we're going to be spending more money in that area, and that's corrections. We passed a modest correctional reform bill last year, but it looks like the state is really just about to abandon that. In fact, the legislature has a number of proposals which would not, in fact, decriminalize some offenses. It would make some things that weren't, you know, a modest fine, all of a sudden we're talking about prison time.
We took some small tentative steps towards corrections reform in the last couple of years. This was a priority of House Speaker Chris Steele to start to be smarter on crime and try to keep certain nonviolent offenders out or enhance the parole system. But they were modest steps, and now we're really seeing backtracking on that. Unfortunately, you have what really ends up being a pretty powerful lobby for locking more people up. And whether that is correctional institutions, DAs, law enforcement, really are still pushing that tough on crime, lock people up. Even though we've seen that most of the people in our prison systems are there for nonviolent offenses, a lot of drug-related offenses, and there really are alternatives that we could be pushing. But as it is, our prison population has continued to rise, and we have...
And we've had steep cuts in correctional funding, too.
So
that makes a dangerous situation.
We're locking people up, but we're not paying adequately to ensure the safety of the correctional officers and the inmates. So now our prisons are at 98-99% capacity on any given day. They're backed up into local jails, and yet our staffing is somewhere around 60-65% of the levels that they're supposed to be at. So, you know, all the folks who've looked at this have said that it's essentially a powder keg that could blow it at any time. So we have to be smarter on sentencing, smarter on crime, and figure out how do we make sure that our penitentiaries are reserved for the most violent offenders, and then how do we fund adequately the facilities for those who are there.
The other area is DHS. We had this DHS settlement in the foster care system. While it originally did not, the settlement looks like it's going to cost the state a lot more money. You're going to have more case officers.
Right.
And you know, we responded by totally overhauling DHS, which I assume is still in the process of occurring.
Right. We're seeing some real progress in that area. The legislature did come in with more money last year. The governor had additional money for the Pinnacle plan. We heard today that the plan is moving ahead successfully and that the court order is being followed. But that is, the Pinnacle plan is just one of many growing obligations on state government. If you look at our pension liabilities, if you look at our infrastructure needs with roads and bridges and crumbling buildings, you look at the water
crumbling
plan.
Crumbling capitals.
Right. You look at all these things and you realize that the cost of funding the core services that are already in place is going to continue to grow. And that's why we have to have a serious debate about our tax system, one that is guided by the question of what do we expect state government to do, what's it going to cost, and how are we going to fund it? And this approach of we're going to just cut taxes and let the other problems solve themselves is simply a wrong-headed approach. And yet, rather than have a serious fiscal plan put into place, what we're seeing coming from leadership each year is, well, let's just cut the top income tax rate without there being real compelling evidence that that's going to provide benefit, that that's going to really help us meet our goals as a state for a well-trained workforce and secure communities, and certainly not going to help us meet our goals of having our tax system aligned with our spending obligations.
My guest today is David Blatt. He's the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. As we talk about the various tax cut plans that are being considered in the legislature, two main proposals: the governor's plan, which would call for reducing the top rate from 5.25% to 5%. That would have about $110 million impact on the state. The Senate plan lowers the top rate a little further, of a half percent, from 5.25 to 4.75. That will be offset by a number of tax breaks and the like. But that still will have an impact on the budget of, what, $125 million?
It's actually pretty comparable to the governor's plan.
So about, you know, $10 to $15 million difference. So.
Yeah, $110 million each of them. Again, the differences are, one, that the Senate plan takes the top rate lower but offsets about half of the loss. But also the Senate says that their tax cut wouldn't go into effect next year. They'd wait until the year after. And Senate leaders, to their credit, I would say, have said that there needs to be a substantial increase in education funding next year. So a number of the Senate appropriations chairs and committee chairs wrote a letter to the president pro tem saying that they're calling for $75 to $100 million more in education funding. That would at least get us some of the way back towards restoring the cuts that we've seen in recent years, and also helping schools meet the new responsibilities that they have for a variety of mandates.
Everything from the third grade reading level test. Yes, exactly.
And right. The ACE requirements, and now we have Common Core standards being put into place. We really have passed a pretty far-reaching education reform agenda in recent years. What we haven't done is put the money in place that would allow these reforms to be successful. And I think that is creating a lot of stress on teachers and schools and on families. When you say we're going to demand higher performance, better results, at the same time, fewer teachers in the school, we're looking at substantial cuts in special education funding, for example. We've zeroed out funding for reading sufficiency and Literacy First and other programs. So it really is a very tough situation.
We haven't mentioned one other factor that could complicate the state budget, and that's the sequester. We mentioned that a little bit, but really when you look at the atmosphere in Washington, I think probably the best a state could hope for is stable, no growth, no cuts. That's probably the best case scenario with the two parties at loggerheads and basically log jammed, if you will. But if anything, the atmosphere seems to be cuts, and cuts to states will be probably a popular. The sequester has cuts to states, and certainly the climate in Washington is budget cuts. Any sense that the Oklahoma legislature is taking that into mind?
There has been some attention to it. The speaker, for example, Speaker Shannon, has called on each agency. There's a bill now to present scenarios for what would happen if federal funding is cut by 25%. What we don't know is how would we continue to run the programs if those scenarios were realized. Under the sequester, schools, all of the various education funding stream, whether it's Title I, whether it's special education funding, Head Start, school lunch programs, I believe, all those funding streams would be looking at 8 to 10% cuts. Now, it's not going to be during this current school year. They won't take effect until the upcoming 2013-2014 school year. But unless there's some deal made to reverse the sequester, then schools are going to have those cuts taking effect in September on top of what's happened at the state level and on top of what looks like it's going to get hit with local property tax revenues as a result of our having exempted intangible personal property with State Question 766 last year.
Well, let's talk about 766. Do we know what it's going to cost?
We don't have a definite idea.
This is really interesting. We don't really know how much this tax break is going to cost.
Intangible property is very hard to get a precise measure of.
It's hard to even know what it is.
Right.
And it's everything from an idea to a logo.
It includes certain things like stocks and bonds, which are measurable, but it does include, as you said, logo, patents, goodwill. We know that up until now, centrally assessed properties, which includes telecommunications, utilities, railroads, they have been assessed in a manner that included intangible property. And now that intangible property, whatever is within that scope, is going to be exempted. And we won't know until the tax bills come due this spring, in the next couple of months, how much these corporations are claiming is exempt from property under intangible property. We're hearing, though, that for some of the telecommunications companies, AT&T and Cox and others, that they may claim that a major share of their total value is from intangible properties and therefore exempt. And the experience has been in other states that it has to get settled through the courts, that companies provide a certain interpretation and then it gets challenged and it could get tied up.
Eventually the courts will decide what intangible property is.
The numbers we're hearing, though, in terms of the impact, if you look at all the centrally assessed entities, how much they've paid in the past, we're seeing estimates of anywhere from $50 million to $100 million to, we've heard, $120 million of reduced property tax revenue. And the state takes in about $2 billion in local property tax revenue a year. So it could be a pretty substantial chunk. And remember that 60% of that property tax revenues goes to education.
Mm. Well, let's talk about, in our last few minutes, alternatives to income tax rate cut, and that's the top rate. There are a couple other ideas out there that sort of get thrown out there and as quickly thrown away. Looking at something that would benefit everybody, a grocery tax cut. Now, not the local tax, but just the state tax, even a state tax. If you spend $100, $150 a week in groceries, that's $40 a month, $30, $40 a month. How much would that cost? Do we know?
There have been some estimates that it would be about $200 million.
So that's quite a bit more than we're talking about here.
Sales tax on groceries. It does present some complications in terms of local municipalities are very heavily dependent in Oklahoma on the sales tax.
But they have their own tax. Can't you do away with the state tax without doing away with the local tax?
That's been considered, and that may be an option. But I agree with the main point, which is if we want to provide a tax relief that would be broad-ranging, then the sales tax on groceries would provide much broader benefits. We should remember that in Oklahoma, we do have a sales tax relief credit, which families, households up to $50,000 can claim a credit of $40 per household member, and that is refundable, so you get that back even if you don't have income tax liability. And that has always been seen as having been intended to offset the sales tax on groceries for those low and moderate income families. We have failed to index the eligibility forever, and we've failed to increase or index the amount of the credit. So that has actually
$40 is what, about a month or two worth of groceries, basically.
But if you have four people in the family, that is $160 credit. Uh-huh. So it's not insignificant, and that is a $30 to $40 million tax credit that's out there. So Oklahoma has taken some action, but that one would be broad-based. There are other things that you could do, too.
I was going to say lengthening the brackets.
That's right.
This is probably the best way to give everybody a tax cut, which is moving the brackets further up in income.
Right.
And that gives the guy who's making $1 million the same tax cut the person making $50,000 does, or whatever, you know.
So what's happened is we have about six income tax brackets in Oklahoma where we tax your first $500 at 0.5% and the next $1,000 at 1%. So like the federal system, it is a graduated income tax.
But ours is all squeezed at the bottom.
Yeah. These were the brackets that were created and last revised in 1812, maybe 1975. So you actually reach the top bracket at taxable income of $17,000 for a family. Now, you do get to claim the standard deduction, personal exemption. So people who make under about $30,000 are not in the top bracket, but our top bracket does kick in very quickly. So one thing you could do, as you said, would be to stretch out the brackets. Rather than having the brackets the 1% bracket start at 1,000, the 2% bracket start at 2,000, you could stretch that out. It means that more of your first dollars would be taxed at lower rates. That would still be a fairly costly tax cut, but it would be much more broadly distributed, as you said, rather than cutting the top income tax rate, which primarily benefits those with most of their income in the top bracket.
Now, I know there are some people hearing that says, well, if you don't lower the top rate, how, if I'm at the top rate, how am I getting a tax cut? And this is another big misnomer, is the fact that if you're in the top rate and you're paying 5.25%, right, you're paying 5.25% on all your income, and you're not.
You're not. You're paying the top rate only on your taxable income above that level. So if you make $35,000, say, roughly $3,000 to $5,000 of your income is taxed at 5.25%, some of it is taxed at 5%, some of it is taxed at 4%, and so on. So your effective rate, which is you take your total income divided by total tax, the effective rate is closer to 2% to 3% for most Oklahomans, some 4%. Nobody's paying 5.25%.
Theoretically impossible.
It's essentially impossible.
Perhaps some of our billionaires in the state are getting close.
One thing we haven't talked about, though, is why is then the push to lower the top rate? And I think most of the proponents say that we need to lower the top rate because we are competing with Texas, which has no income tax, and now Kansas, which passed a radical budget-busting tax plan last year, and now their top rate is under 5%. And so they're talking about Oklahoma being squeezed. But there really is very weak evidence that businesses locate based on the top income tax rate, or that people move. You can find anecdotal evidence here and there, but for the most part, there are a lot of factors that go into investment decisions, location decisions, and the literature is pretty overwhelming that what businesses are looking for when they decide where to invest and grow, they're looking at the quality of the workforce, infrastructure, connections to markets, the quality of life in community, healthy communities. All of these things require investment of public dollars. And so if we just slash our top income tax rate, we're going to see very little benefit in terms of people coming here, but it really does have that cost that we've been seeing. We have to be more serious about how we spend tax dollars effectively and how we ensure that we have an adequate revenue system, that it is fair and adequate to meet our needs going forward. And unfortunately, this approach that we're going to just cut taxes first and let everything else get figured out later is really the wrong approach.
Well, we'll have to see what the legislature does. David Blatt, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. If you'd like to learn more about the Policy Institute's positions and issues, visit their website at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.